This episode is brought to you by Dietz and Watson.
Molly, it's time we have the talk about hot dogs.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm looking for a hot dog that's the real deal, Matthew.
Like a classic hot dog that, like, when you think of, like, the platonic ideal of a hot dog, I recommend Dietz and Watson's Dietz Dogs.
Ah, well, I've heard that they're handcrafted and made using only Dietz and Watson premium meat.
I can vouch for this because Dietz and Watson sent us a big box of hot dogs and other delights, and wife of the show, Lori, and I had them for dinner last night. We had the classic beef Dietz dogs with toasted buns with sauerkraut and pickled jalapenos and Dietz and Watson ballpark-style yellow mustard.
Do you think you'd recommend Dietz and Watson hot dogs for fried rice?
Oh, yeah. Fried rice with some sliced hot dogs. I'm going to be doing that soon. Wife of the show, Lori, is going to be making the hot dog flour buns from Christina Cho's cookbook, Mooncakes and Milk Bread. Very excited for this.
And I'm especially pleased because Dietz and Watson does things the right way. So this means, like, no additives, no fillers, no artificial flavors, no cutting corners. You can feel good about this stuff.
Dietz and Watson. It's a family thing since 1939.
Shop now at dietzandwatson.com/the right way.
That's Dietz, D-I-E-T-Z, and watson.com/the right way.
I'm Molly.
And I'm Matthew.
And this is Spilled Milk, the show where we cook something delicious, eat it all, and it's our 600th episode.
Yes, and so we're going to do this episode like the seasoned professionals that we are.
That's right.
Seasoned to taste.
Yeah, we are nothing but professional, as you know, because you, listener, have been here for, I don't know, maybe 600 episodes.
Yeah, no, all of our listeners have been here since episode one. We don't even allow new listeners. We're very exclusive.
Yeah.
We're a gated community of
Congratulations on making it into the exclusive audience of the 600th episode.
Yeah, do not lose your membership card because we charge $1,000 to replace it.
That's right.
So happy 600 to everyone. What do you think we should do for episode 1,000?
Well, I mean, should we say what we're doing for episode 600?
Oh, that's probably a good idea.
Okay. So we decided, perhaps actually Watzel suggested it.
I think she did.
That we would have champagne for our 600th episode.
And not just that, also talk about champagne.
Also talk about champagne. And here's the thing. Here's the really good news for us. I mean, not for you guys, because you never get to eat what we're having. But right after we tape this episode, we're taping a pizza rolls episode.
Which you will get to listen to
next
week.
Listen to. But so to celebrate our 600th episode, what we're really doing is we're eating champagne. I mean, drinking champagne and eating pizza rolls.
Yeah, no, like this champagne has got a subtle bouquet. It's got a very chewy, gummy texture.
I think for episode 1000, didn't you suggest that we eat people?
I think I did. Okay. So listeners,
hold us to it. Is that a reflection of the likelihood of us making it to episode 1000, or what was that?
I think maybe it's the likelihood of, like, us living in, like, a true dystopian post-apocalyptic society.
Where all there will be to eat is, I don't know, like...
I think I said we should eat, like, Soylent, but not like the entrepreneurial, like, tech bro Soylent that's an actual product, but the one from the movie that's made from people.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen the movie.
I have seen the movie. It is very dull. And then at the end, he yells, Soylent Green is people. And that's what you're supposed to take away from it.
Oh, that's what it means?
Yeah.
I thought it means Soylent Green is people. Like, Soylent Green is, like, your friend.
It's not your friend. You ate your friend.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, it might be nutritious.
Okay, well, if things keep going the way they've been going, we'll be eating our friends. We'll be eating each other.
Okay.
For our 100th episode.
For our 100th episode. If you go back and listen to episode 100, Molly and I ate each other.
Ew. Okay, but no, really. Matthew,
no, let's get serious.
It's time this show finally grew up. Let's talk about champagne. Is there any champagne on your memory lane?
There is. I definitely don't remember the first time I had champagne, although I think it was probably, like, in my early teens, maybe. Like, you know, my parents were of the, like, let the kids have a sip. Kind of approach.
And would you have hated it then?
No.
No, you liked it?
I would have liked it.
Okay. My parents were also of the let the kids have a sip approach. And I remember, I think, tasting beer more than I remember tasting wine.
Yeah, no, my dad would definitely give me a sip of, we talked about this before, that he really liked a now discontinued beer called Watney's Red Barrel. And that's the beer I remember getting a taste of.
That is such a good dad name.
Isn't it?
Beer. Yeah, Watney's Red Barrel. Okay, but anyway, I'm pretty sure that I would have also tasted champagne under the same circumstances that you did. You know, my dad, as everyone knows, is the founder of Altoids.
Yes.
Back in the 1800s or something?
I think 1700s.
1700s. He also is an endive man.
Yep.
He was also something else, but he also was somebody who he really like believed. My dad was a kind of hedonist, I would say.
Ooh.
He believed in, you know, ordering foie gras whenever it's on the menu. I mean, this was also like a symbol of my father's class. Anyway, he believed in ordering foie gras whenever it was on the menu. Sweetbreads.
I believe as an indicator of class in ordering foie gras whenever it's on the Wendy's 4 for $4.
Me too. Yeah, we've fallen from grace. My dad also believed in like drinking the good stuff.
Yeah.
I think my dad also, I mean, he almost certainly was the kind of guy who had a beer or a glass of wine with dinner every night, but it was never like, it was always something that he was happy to be drinking that was interesting in flavor, and champagne was like, there was no occasion too small.
Oh, sure. Would this be a good time to pretend that we didn't already open the bottle and start drinking it? Oh, very good. Yeah, that's the classic sound of a champagne bottle opening with the triple pop. Or did you just open 3 bottles? What?
Ash has this thing that they do where they can make their lips pop really well.
Okay.
And they'll come up behind me and they'll go.
Oh, that was good.
But they're saying babe. They're going.
Oh. It's kind of disturbing.
It's kind of disturbing. This is our mating ritual.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, champagne. It was going around.
Okay, and that's our episode.
That's our episode.
One other specific champagne memory lane I have is that in 2000, Wife of the Show Lori and I went to Paris for the first and only time in our lives. Mm-hmm. And we went to, I believe this was at La Régalade. A famous bistro that might still be in business in Paris. And the champagne that was on the menu was Krug Grand Cuvée, which is like a really fancy champagne available by the glass. Mm-hmm. And so we, of course, ordered like the fancy champagne. And I think she also had like Blini with caviar. And she was like, I'm in Paris. I'm drinking champagne. And with caviar, this is the best.
Oh, I love that. Wotzel wins yet again.
Yeah.
So during the years that I co-owned Delancey, one of the best things about it was, you know, because we would have wine reps who came by and we had a number of different distributors who we supplied our menu from, we would get to taste these really fantastic champagnes that otherwise are really hard to find on the market unless you have a great wine shop near you. And then we could buy them at like wholesale prices.
Nice.
So, you know, for the price of like a low-end champagne at the grocery store, we could buy like a grower's champagne, something made by like a small producer. And
which I believe is what we're drinking today.
I think so too. I was really I was aware of how lucky I was in that era, and I guess I could probably still order those things through Delancey, but I don't tend to.
Well, let me skip ahead a little bit, because the champagne we're drinking is from Louis Armand. It's a non-vintage brut champagne. And I got it at European Vine Selections, which is a wonderful little tiny wine store on 15th Avenue East in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And so this was a champagne that Lori and I had on New Year's Eve, because for no reason on New Year's Eve this year, we were like, you know what we haven't done in like a decade is drink champagne on New Year's Eve. Let's go to our local wine store and get some champagne. So we picked out this bottle, mostly because it had a nice looking label.
It has a very pretty label.
And I was delighted. I mean, it was delicious, of course.
It's very good.
But also I was delighted to find that like I knew that, like, when I started getting interested in food, that, like, a basic bottle of champagne from, like, the grocery store was, like, $30.
That's right.
And I was delighted that this bottle was, like, $36.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Isn't that fantastic?
Great? And they have, like, some nice, like, vintage champagnes there that are, like, $55 or $65. So, like, it's still, it's not cheap.
You can easily spend that amount on a bottle of, like, a larger production champagne at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Well, very cool.
So, would you like to learn about the history and production of champagne?
I would.
Please say yes, because I did so much research.
Yes. And I have to say, too, that this is an episode that I think kind of like maybe whiskey and coffee. We might have had this on our like to-do list for a very long time.
Oh, yeah, did we? Probably.
But I have always felt daunted by doing an episode on a product like this that has so many people out there who know like way more and tasted way more than we have. So I'm really glad you did the research on this, and I can just sit back and sip my champagne.
Yeah. Okay. So like, if I get anything wrong, just go to everythingspilledmilk.reddit.com and post on the thread about this episode.
Yes. Oh wait. And so we're talking about champagne as in like of the designation.
Yeah. So the word champagne, like there's like a minor level of controversy about like what you can and can't call champagne. We're sticking with like the, you know, technically it's an AOC, an appellation d'origine contrôlée, which means that the French government has, or is it the government or like commercial organization? Anyway, there are very specific rules about like where it can be made, only in the northeast corner of France, like which grapes you can use, and like the method for producing the wine, and anything outside of that region or outside of those methods, like they come after you if you try and call it champagne. Obviously, there are really good sparkling wines produced all over the world.
So any sparkling wine that is not made in that region might be called a Cremant, at least a French sparkling wine made outside of champagne.
We'll talk about a specific Cremant during the history section.
Oh, God. Oh, let me loose. Let's do this.
Okay. So let's talk about the history of champagne. So I started by pulling up not just the champagne Wikipedia article, but the history of champagne Wikipedia article. And oh, shit, this article is 6,000 words long. So initially I was like, I am too lazy to read this. Let's just pretend it was invented in 1979 by Marie-Françoise Champagne or by your dad.
Yeah, my dad.
But, you know, actually, like, it's kind of interesting. So,
Okay. According
to Wikipedia, first I read this. The history of Champagne began when the Romans planted vineyards in this region of northeast France in the 5th century or possibly earlier.
Oh,
and I was like, kill me now.
Yeah.
But until the 17th century, Champagne was a white or rosé still wine made from Pinot Noir grapes.
Interesting. Okay.
So not fizzy.
So it did not yet have the méthode champenoise going on.
Right. So, around like, you know, the mid, like the 1600s, Burgundy wine and particularly red Burgundy was getting really popular and well known and getting a reputation as like the good stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's like south of the Champagne region. And so winemakers.
That would be the Loire Valley.
Yes. Winemakers in the Champagne regions were like, we want to make a great red wine like Burgundy. And they tried and it went really badly because the Champagne region is colder than Burgundy. So what would happen is they would like, you know, pick these super ripe grapes. They would, put them in a vat to squeeze the juice, put them in a vat to ferment, and they would ferment for a while until it got too cold. And then the yeast would go dormant. And then in spring, it would wake up and start fermenting again and produce like fizzy wine. They did not like this.
Okay.
Oh, and worse than that, so they would bottle the wine in the fall. The yeast would wake up in the bottle and start fermenting, and the bottles would explode.
Okay.
So, first of all, exploding bottles, not very good for business. And when the bottles survived, the wine was full of bubbles, and people were like, gross, who wants bubbles in your wine?
Yeah.
This is real.
Okay. And so who came along and said, no, you want bubbles in your wine?
So it wasn't one person. So Dom Perignon, who was a monk, is often credited as the inventor of champagne.
So was his name Dom as in like short for Dominic?
It was, he was named after Dom Toretto from the Fast and Furious movies.
Oh, okay.
I think Dom is like a title for a monk. I think he had a different first name. Let's say
he was a Dom.
He was a Dom, and he worked with some subs.
Okay.
He worked at a sub shop.
Okay. And so, and he then became the inventor of champagne because champagne goes really well with subs.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
As well as pizza rolls. So, I kind of guess that probably it was apocryphal that one guy invented champagne, but it's even more interesting than that because he was, you know, a wine, like a, what do you call, like a, an enologist, but he was working to get the bubbles out of wines produced in the Champagne region because they were considered a defect. But, you know, at the same time, they were like, okay, we've got this bubbly wine, we got to sell it, and people liked it.
I have a question.
Yes.
So was it still red or were they like removing the skins by this point?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know.
Okay. Okay.
The bubbly wine became popular in England first and then in France when it became the favorite drink of Philippe II, who became regent in 1715. What's the difference between regent and king? Oh, don't know.
No,
do you know?
No. The regent is, isn't the regent like someone who rules.
Is that when they're like too young to be king?
When there's like, when the king is too young, the regent is sort of the
opposite. Okay. Yeah.
I think so. The regent is the one who actually does the ruling.
Okay. That makes sense.
I can't believe that you're trusting me on this.
I we've been together for 600 years at this point. I trust you on everything.
Okay. Okay, but so were the bottles still exploding, though? Like, this seems like a very uncontrolled experiment that people happen to like.
Yeah, so exploding bottles continue to be a big problem, which made champagne very expensive and inconsistent. So they were selling it as a sparkling wine now, but having trouble making it in quantity. And this was solved in the early 19th century through the development of better bottle technology in England, mostly like thicker bottles with like a big punt in the bottom.
I always wondered about the divot in the bottom.
Yeah, the divot.
This serves a purpose?
It serves two purposes. So it makes the bottle stronger and it makes it easier to rotate the bottle, which is a little spoiler.
Okay. All right. Okay.
All right.
I'll sit tight.
The modern méthode champenoise, which is the procedure that is used to produce champagne to this day, was developed at the Veuve Clicquot Winery under the direction of someone with an excellent name, Barbe Nicole Ponsardin Veuve Clicquot, meaning Widow Clicquot.
Oh, there really was a
Veuve Clicquot, and she really was involved in producing champagne in the modern style.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right.
So what is this méthode champenoise, and can we talk about it for the next 37 minutes, you may be wondering?
Yes, let's try. Because here's the thing. I mean, méthode champenoise is used in the production of all kinds of sparkling wines.
Yes.
Right?
And the French authorities would prefer that if you're making it outside of the Champagne region, you call it méthode traditionnelle, whatever. Okay, so méthode champenoise is a wild and expensive way of making wine. It is better than having a cellar full of broken glass, and it produces great results, but it takes tons of time and labor, as you will see.
Okay.
Okay, so first you make a base wine. The base wine is a very acidic white wine that's fermented in a vat with the gas allowed to escape, so it's not a sparkling wine.
Okay.
And it is not good to drink by itself because it's super, super, super dry. Oh, remember I said earlier they were having trouble fermenting the wine dry because it was too cold?
Mm-hmm.
They realized that they could solve this by picking the grapes earlier so they have less sugar.
Ah, okay. Okay. So they would complete fermentation more quickly?
Right. So before it gets too cold and stops the fermentation.
Got it.
And then you blend this wine, the base wine, with wine from other vintages and other grape pressings to produce your house style. So you want, if you're a champagne house, you want your non-vintage champagne to taste the same year after year. And you do that by blending. And the people who are in charge of blending are considered highly skilled.
Well, hold on. What do you mean by a non-vintage champagne?
Oh, okay. So the vast majority of the champagne that is sold is non-vintage champagne, meaning it's not made with just the grapes of a particular year.
Oh, which
so
this, is why it doesn't usually have a date on it.
So this Louis Armand champagne we're drinking now is non-vintage. It's usually, it's blended from like at least 3 years of harvest, but it can be more.
Okay.
Some years when there's a really good harvest, they will make a vintage champagne, which is in French called a millésime.
Oh, I've seen that.
And that's sold at a much higher price, of course, and considered like a premium product.
Because it would be more difficult, I guess, to get the kind of flavor that they're looking for, or a balanced flavor using only grapes from that harvest.
Okay. And it's supposed to both represent the house style and be unique to that year. So,
Okay.
I don't think I've ever had a vintage champagne, honestly.
If I did, I think I didn't know that was what I was drinking, and right. I certainly didn't do it justice.
Yep. So the wine grapes used in champagne are almost exclusively three grapes, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. The first two are red grapes, but they press the juice and take the skins away before it turns red.
Okay.
So now you've got this this base blended base wine that is not very good to drink, and you bottle it along with a little bit of yeast and sugar to produce a secondary fermentation.
In the bottle.
In the bottle. And you put a cap on it so that it will carbonate. And the temporary cap is just a beer bottle cap in most cases.
Okay.
And you store it on its side in a wine cellar for at least 15 months and up to 8 years. And I think for a vintage champagne, it has to be at least 3 years. So, okay. Like, I don't know, like, if there's vintage 2023 champagne, but if there is, it's not going to be available till like 2027 or later.
I wonder how they know when it's quote unquote ready.
Mm.
Because I guess they can just
pop one open and a taster who knows what to look for, like, sticks his tongue in the bottle. It's real gross. It's like, what was the thing that I was eating that you were like, I can't watch you do that? Grapefruit. Something where I was really sticking my tongue in it.
I'm not sure. I think I blocked it out.
Okay, yeah. Listeners, what was that episode where I was doing something lascivious to a food?
Okay, wait, but I have a question now. Matthew. So we've got this blended wine, little bit of yeast, little bit of sugar in the bottle with a cap on it. And I mean, the yeast, isn't it cloudy?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking of the way yeast looks when I add water to it, right?
Yeah.
It becomes this like milky stuff.
Yeah, that's what's in your wine. That is not what people want.
Unless they're buying natural wines.
Unless they're buying natural wines. Yeah, like there's nothing inherently wrong with a cloudy wine. It's not poisonous and it's not bad to drink if it's well made, but it's not the preference of people who are buying champagne.
Okay.
So now it gets... Now it gets weird. So you remember you asked about the punt, the indentation at the bottom of the bottle?
Yeah.
So they take these bottles that are now fully fermented and transfer them to a different type of wine rack called a pupitre, which means like, is that like a pew?
Maybe.
Like a pulpit?
I'm not sure.
Okay. I feel this was a word that I remember learning in French class and never using.
Would you like me to look it up?
Could you please look it up? Maybe it's like a school desk. It's something.
It seems like I'm going to go with pulpit, but let me find out. Desk. It's a desk.
It's a school desk. Okay, yeah. Great.
Yeah.
All right. So we're sitting in our pupitres. This rack
can also be a lectern.
Great. Yeah. So they put the bottles on a lectern and they give a TED talk. The bottles are pointing down at like a 30 degree angle. And now begins the riddling, a.k.a. Whoa. The remouage in French.
Oh, so having something to do with mixing.
Yes. So once a day, someone who has a terrible job goes into the cellar and gives all the bottles a turn by hand and lets them kind of thunk back into the rack and also adjusts the angle of the rack so they point a little more downward. This goes on for 8 to 10 weeks, and the goal is to get all of that cloudy yeast goop, which is called lees, L-E-E-S, to condense in the very mouth of the bottle.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I want you to say now is that the lees somehow solidify and become the cork. Wouldn't that be great?
Yes. That's exactly what happens.
Okay.
Yeah. When a bottle is corked, it means that the lees
have solidified.
Right.
Okay.
Unfortunately, no. This does not have to be done by hand. Thank God. So it's still done by hand for high end champagnes. Like some poor employee comes in that I really hope they're unionized and they turn all of the bottles every day. But nowadays, for the champagne that we're drinking and all others except for super fancy expensive ones, get riddled using a machine called a gyro palette.
Okay. And it can riddle so it does the turning and the adjusting of angles. And how long does it still go on for 8 to 10 weeks?
No, now I can do this in a few days. If you look at a picture or a video of this, it's like you've put a whole palette of wine onto like a goofy machine that holds it at an angle and kind of bounces it like an amusement park ride.
Okay. Okay.
So we should like get one.
That
and
sounds
like
fun.
Ride in it.
Okay.
Right? And that was invented in the late 60s. So before that, it was all done by hand.
The legend of Cayman Jack is just around the corner. Mixed with blue agave nectar. real lime juice, and cane sugar for the perfect balance of sweet, salty, and sour every time. Discover legendary taste with Cayman Jack, America's number one margarita. Premium flavored malt beverage. Please drink responsibly. All registered trademarks used under license by American Vintage Beverage Company, Chicago, Illinois.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
So let's pause and, okay, and have a drink, because this method of making champagne, not done yet.
So nice.
Okay, so now you have a plug of yeast in the mouth of the bottle. Yum, yum, yum. And unfortunately, it does not automatically turn into a cork. So how do you get it out without just mixing it back in? And it used to be done manually, essentially using surgical extraction.
Wow.
So, like, there were people who were highly trained to get the yeast plug out without stirring it back into the wine.
Wow. Okay.
But nowadays, and for quite a while, it's done by freezing the neck of the bottle and then popping the cap off so that the frozen plug shoots out.
And then do they, like, quickly recap it?
Yeah, sort of. We'll get there.
Okay.
So the bottles travel standing up along a conveyor belt, and freezing liquid is sprayed onto the top. So that, like, the top of the bottle freezes.
And then their warts are removed.
And then the wart is just, like popped off. And then it inevitably grows back.
Yeah, okay. Great. Okay. So wait, then they're laid out on their sides.
They're laid out on their sides, and a machine with, like a several bottle openers on it pops the like, bottle caps off, and the wine shoots out in a very, like, ejaculatory way. I watched a video called The Moment of Disgorgement.
Okay. I see you didn't link to it here.
I should, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Or is it a home video? Or?
Yeah, it's an amateur video. To be honest, there was a video called The Moment of Disgorgement. It was mostly like a guy talking about wine, and then I found another one with a boring title that actually showed the spewing.
Okay.
But yeah, we'll link to that. So now what you have is a mostly full bottle of wine, which is just what you want to buy at the store, right?
Yeah.
So now they add the dosage.
Okay.
That is a mixture of more base wine, sugar, and sulfur dioxide as a preservative. Very small amounts of sugar and sulfur dioxide, especially if you're making a brut champagne, which is a dry style. So for that style of champagne, which is the most popular, a tiny amount of sugar is used. There's a style called brut nature that has no sugar in the dosage if you're really hardcore. And then, of course, there's demi-sec, I think, is the second most popular, which is like a lightly sweet champagne. So more sugar is added.
Okay.
Then they put in the cork and put that cage on top, and now you are actually done.
Wow. Okay. Woo! Wow. It's no wonder, actual champagne is as expensive as it is.
Yeah.
If
I'm
going to
pause and put this bottle
way
in the fridge, because I don't want it to, like,
okay, I'm
gonna go
have
flat.
I'm just going to have a tiny
bit. And then
I
want to get it back out when we have pizza rolls in a minute.
Okay, there we go. Wow. Fascinating, Matthew. I see you do have a nice champagne cork there. Excellent. So was this style of wine, was it invented there in Champagne?
Well, the Champagne people would like you to think so, but probably not. Historians tend to think it was invented in Limoux in Languedoc, where Blanquette de Limoux and Crémant de Limoux are made. And to this day, that would have been like in the 16th century.
Wow.
But the method was refined and codified in the Champagne region.
I think Brandon and I served a Crémant de Limoux at our wedding.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's delicious.
It can be great. Like Spanish cavas can be great. Mm-hmm. You know, sparkling wines in the champagne style from Australia or California could be great.
Is Prosecco made using the méthode champenoise?
I believe it is not.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is because it's too cheap to be typically. There may be some Proseccos made that way, but like to really use the méthode champenoise, you are producing at least like a $30 bottle of wine.
Okay.
Maybe you could like get it down to like, $26 if you're you're not importing it. But why did Kava, I say $26?
I have no idea. Kava is made, or like some, true Kava?
Yeah. Okay. So some Kavas, like if you're getting like a $7 Kava, no, it's not. But okay. But there are Spanish Kavas made in the Champagne style.
So is Kava not, I know you didn't do research into Kava,
we're doing a Kava episode for episode 1000.
Does Kava have like a DOC or an AOC kind of thing?
I mean, there definitely is like a controlled appellation program in Spain, but I don't know, like if just Kava without some other qualifier fits with that.
Yeah. Okay. So how does rosé champagne happen? Like, is it basically the same grapes? They just leave the skins longer?
That is one way of making it. And that is like the fancy, expensive way.
Okay.
Most commonly, if you're buying like a regular priced rosé champagne, they've just mixed a little bit of red wine into the base wine that still has to be produced in Champagne, in the Champagne region.
Okay. So hold on. Oh, I see. Now you're going to talk about Blanc de Blanc and Noir de Noir.
I love. Can you say Blanc de Blanc again?
Blanc de Blanc.
Yeah,
like kind of hard to say. Blanc de Noir,
yeah.
Blanc de Blanc.
Blanc de Blanc. There's several special kinds of champagne. There's rosé. There's Blanc de Blanc is champagne produced from all Chardonnay grapes. Hmm. Blanc de Noir is champagne produced from all Pinot Noir grapes. I'm not really sure like how you would decide that one of those is the thing you want. I guess if you really know what wine tastes like, or if like, I feel like so much about champagne in particular is like whatever makes you feel fancy in the way you want to feel fancy. Right?
I think that for most of us in the States, because champagne is such a special occasion thing, and because we don't actually have that many choices.
Right.
So if you go to the store and you're like really wanting to shell out or to impress somebody, you're going to get your like Veuve Clicquot or whatever, and you're not going to pay attention to whether it's Blanc de Noir or whatever. Like we, I think, are looking at just the name.
Yeah, I think so. Although they do sell some of the special types, like even at QFC. Near me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I'm sure you're right. But I think that, yeah, it would be really interesting to see how different it would be.
I see where you're going with this. Like, you wanted me to spend the show's money on, like, a tasting of, like, seven champagnes.
That's exactly
okay,
right.
Great.
Okay.
The more premium, the better. Like, mm-hmm. Cristal all the way.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about vintage champagne, Millésime. There's then most champagne houses will have a prestige cuvée, which is their fancy top-of-the-line one, like Dom Pérignon, which is made by Moët de Chandon. Cristal, which is made by Roderay.
I've never known how to pronounce that.
Or Krug Grand Cuvée, which is the one that Laurie and I had in Paris because mm-hmm. we're fancy.
Mm-hmm.
And this one we had today, like, I feel like when I went to, like, try and learn more about the champagne that we're drinking right now, the Louis Armand, I found that they had a really shitty website that made me feel really good about drinking it.
Yeah, no, I think that seems right for, like, a smaller production champagne. Like,
yeah,
that's what
like,
I'm
the,
after.
The big
I want
name
a bad
ones,
website.
Like you know, Moët de Chandon is owned by LVMH, which is, like, a gigantic international liquor conglomerate. And they have a fantastic website because they have, like, gobs of money to hire, like, webmasters and stuff. And, you know, this, like, small producer probably does not.
That is correct.
So
here's a question for you.
Okay.
I remember being told at some point, maybe when I was, like, at some point in my 20s, I remember being told, oh, man, champagne will give you a wicked hangover. Have you ever, I mean, I know neither you nor I have probably had many hangovers in our lives because we don't party.
Drink very much, right.
Do you like how I use party like as a verb?
I
don't do that very often.
Yeah, we're young people who love to party, but in our own way.
I rage.
Yes.
Anyway.
I remember when I went to that Brahms and Radiohead symphony show?
Yeah.
Party.
I thought you meant Brahms, the ice cream store.
Yeah, remember when I went to, that's how I party with that, like by
Borgs.
Pounding malts.
Anyway, were you ever told this kind of thing about champagne? Were you?
I have heard that. Like, I honestly don't know how much truth there is to the idea that, like, certain types of beverages will give you a worse or better hangover.
I mean, I wonder if what was actually said to me was something having to do with cheap champagne. But then again, I don't know what difference it would make because isn't it alcohol and alcohol?
My guess is, like, champagne in general and cheap champagne, like, it's easy to drink. Like, you're going to drink more of it than you intended to pretty easily, probably. And that will give you a worse hangover for sure.
I wonder if one of our listeners who parties would get in touch with us and let us know.
Weirdly, we haven't gotten any emails from that listener yet.
Okay.
I don't know. But yeah, listener who parties, please get in touch. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question for you. Have you ever opened a bottle of champagne with a sword or smashed one over the bow of a ship?
Okay. I have done neither. I think I learned about...
Really? I do that once a week.
I think that I learned about wine being smashed over the bow of a ship maybe from watching The Crown.
Oh, really?
When Queen Elizabeth's personal ship was...
When you said personal, I was imagining a person like, you know, her personal trainer or like her courtier or something.
But shut up mid afternoon sit ups. No, what I was going to say is I seem to recall there's like sort of like a sepia toned thing where she's like giving a speech from the bow of the boat.
What is the difference between the prow and the bow? I don't either.
Anyway,
we are certified ship experts.
Then they break a bottle against the side, which is how they christen like a new ship that's heading out on its first voyage or that's being prepared for its first voyage.
Do they have to wear goggles? It seems like that would be like there really would be a real dangerous. Danger of eye injuries.
Hold on, but I do want to talk about opening a bottle of champagne with a sword.
Yes.
Or with like a knife, which is often called sabering.
Mm-hmm.
So, Matthew, before we turned on the recording for this episode, I said to you, it seems like people who are into food and who are on Instagram always like post a video of themselves like sabering a bottle of champagne.
Oh my God.
On a fancy occasion.
I just now am realizing that you said sabering and not savoring.
No, sabering.
I thought you were saying over and over that they posted themselves savoring champagne. I'm like,
no,
what are you talking about? That sounds so boring.
Sabering.
Okay.
Yeah. So
no,
like,
now I'm on board. I'm on board the ship.
No,
it sounds
but
cool.
I always thought this was so dumb. What is the big deal? Why do I need to cut off the like glands penis of the champagne bottle?
Wow, I was totally into this until just now.
That's
totally
like
what it is.
What
yeah.
part it is. Why do I need to do that with a knife in order to truly have a good time?
I mean, to remove the yeast plug, first of all.
No.
But
you've seen this too, haven't you?
I've seen this done. I mean, of course it's dumb. Like, I don't think anyone doing it thinks it's smart. Like, you know, because everything involving champagne is like silly or like overly traditional in some way.
So last night, Ash and I started the latest season of Selling Sunset, which is one of two reality shows that I've enjoyed in my life. The other being Love is Blind.
Oh, Love Blind.
Love Blindland.
Yeah, I know you did
island.
Watch some Love Island.
There's this little island between Greenland and Iceland called Blindland.
Okay.
And that's where they record this show. No, I've watched a little bit of Love Island. Yeah, the latest season of Selling Sunset came out the day before or a few days ago. And
great.
Whatever. And last night, my spouse and I were like, let's eat dinner and watch some truly stupid television. And in it, there was a character who sabered a bottle of champagne.
Of course.
And I was just like, of course. Of course, if we're watching Selling Sunset, somebody's going to saber a bottle of champagne.
I feel like I detect just a hint of jealousy.
No, I don't. Like I
think if we go into your red carpeted love dungeon, which I know has been converted into a home office, there's a saber in the closet.
Fine.
And you're going to claim it's just for your fencing practice, but we know that it's
no,
like
that's my AP.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you choose the wrong kind of sword, if you choose the floppy one
yeah.
for your champagne opening, it's so embarrassing.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I think it's like just dumb.
Well, I think it's cool. So there. Have you ever had champagne and caviar? I think the only time I ever had was the time I tasted some of wife of the show Lori's blini with caviar in Paris.
Matthew, I feel like there are moments in this show when we bump up against
you've had it so many times.
So
you had it some for breakfast.
I did today, actually. Yeah.
So okay, great. Let's move on.
Okay.
Should we move on to segments? Do we have anything else to say about champagne?
I think we should say, so Matthew, I see that you have champagne flutes.
Oh, of course.
Okay, and you're somebody who, by your own admission, you don't drink champagne very often. So how did these come into your world? Do you think it's important to drink champagne out of a flute?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. I think nothing is more important. I believe we got these like when we bought some champagne like 10 years ago or something, and probably got them at QFC, and they were probably like $2 each.
Okay.
And we only own two of them. I don't know. Like, isn't this like something that wine people debate? Like, what's the best shape of wine glass for champagne or for like other types of wines? Who cares?
It depends on like how it has to do with like how long you want your bubbles to last in it or whatever.
Or do you
right?
want like more like bouquet to erupt? I don't know.
Pretty much every like wine glass of any type I have ever had either came from Brandon Pettit finding it at Goodwill.
Of course.
Or from being like, it was like a hand-me-down from the restaurant when we broke enough of them that we had to like totally resupply our wine glasses and would often switch styles.
Sure.
So I don't have champagne flutes. I have coupes.
Okay. Yeah. That's the other kind.
That's the other kind. Yeah.
And like, is it going to taste bad out of one of them and good out of the other one? No. Who cares?
That's correct. I feel the same way.
Right.
My mother has ridiculous champagne flutes. Ooh. They're so tall and they're like, they're crystal and they've got like these deep grooves carved into the side. I mean, they are, it's over the top.
Did she carve them by hand?
She did.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. So I think we've done champagne, and next week, Prosecco. We probably should do a Prosecco episode sometime. It's very popular, and maybe there are things we could learn about it, too.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. I have a beak of the week.
You do?
Yes.
Okay.
I have to go get my laptop because this is the most ridiculous bird I've ever seen.
You've got sharp claws so you can perch up high. You've got those wings because they help you fly. You're such an interesting bird. It's beak of the week.
Molly, have you ever heard of a type of bird called a nightjar?
No.
I hadn't either until the other day. A nightjar is sort of, it's a nocturnal bird that feeds on insects, so it's sort of like an owl and sort of like a bat, but also shaped kind of like a regular, like sparrow, crow kind of bird.
You know, what I think of when you say nightjar is I think of the night hob from The NeverEnding Story.
Probably related. So, okay. Nightjars are these weird, like, they're like, you know, when they go into a cave and they're like, these are all like the weird organisms that live in caves and they don't have eyes and they're like, you know, all drab colored because they live in caves.
Yes.
That's what nightjars are like. They only come out at night. They have jaws that open super wide because they fly through the air and eat insects in flight.
Okay.
Okay. So let me introduce you to the standard winged nightjar.
What is this? It looks like it is sporting, I don't know, like weird hair extensions.
Yeah. Okay. So most nightjars look sort of just kind of like a gray lump. This one looks like a gray lump that has sprouted these gigantic feathers for like mating. Like this is the male and this is like mating season, and it grows these enormous feathers that are the size of peacock feathers. Like the bird is like 7 inches long and the feathers are 15 inches long.
Yeah. It looks like it has some sort of like a growth hormone problem just in these two feathers.
Right. And most of the feather is like just like naked feather spine. It's like it's holding up two flags.
Hello. Like,
right. And so I absolutely have never seen a weirder bird in my life. And there are some weird birds
out
there.
I thought that the beak was going to be a lot bigger and more like crocodile-y.
Yeah.
Because this beak just looks like a little sparrow's
beak. It does. But then it opens
its
mouth ridiculously wide.
Can you find a picture of it?
I can find another nightjar doing that. This, yeah, okay. I knew this was going to happen.
Yeah. How did you come upon this?
I've been like weirdly into birds lately.
Oh, wow. Oh, man. Oh!
Pretty scary, right?
Wow, this is intense.
Yeah. But kind of cute, right?
This one also is kind of like a cobra coming out of a basket, like in a Disney cartoon.
Yeah, so I think of nightjars as being like walruses, because I love walruses because they're so ugly that they've gone all the way back around to being cute.
Yeah.
And nightjars are like that too.
Do the feathers come off at the end of breeding season
and then
they have to regrow them?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, I love this.
And so when they fly, it looks like they're being pursued by bats.
Okay.
One other thing about the standard wing nightjar is that the Latin name is Caprimulgus longipennis.
Oh, wow. I like it. Says everything you need to know.
Yeah, Caprabulgus means goat milker. And
really?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah. So, I'm sorry. We are really going to retire the segment because that was the weirdest bird.
That was definitely the weirdest bird. Thank you, Matthew.
Molly, do we have any spilled mail?
We sure do. We have some spilled mail from listener Tom. Like many food people before me, I have wondered whether writing, reading, or podcasting about food would have put me in good stead for a restaurant chef. I'll always thank Anthony Bourdain for his words of wisdom in Medium Raw. If you're 32 years old and considering a career in professional kitchens, if you're wondering if perhaps you are too old, let me answer that question for you. Yes, you are too old. I think the year I read it, I was 33. Lucky escape. Thanks, Tony. Have either of you wanted to work in a professional kitchen? Why did you think you would have been good or bad? Cheers, Tom from London.
I can answer this. No, never, because it looked like really hard work and I'm very lazy.
I wanted to work in a professional kitchen. I wanted to be a pastry chef when I was like 20 in college. Through a friend of a friend, I got a summer internship just like 2 days a week at the restaurant Greens in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. Famous restaurant.
I very quickly learned that the repetitive nature of restaurant cooking and the precision required of it, and also the grueling hours, the physical difficulty of being on your feet for that many hours, was really not for me. And I went in the absolute other direction until my then spouse decided he wanted to open a restaurant. And I was 30 when we opened it. And I worked...
Ooh, just under the wire, I guess.
Yes. I worked in the kitchen every night we were open for the first 4 months. And I cried regularly. I was filled with rage.
Yeah.
I hated it with every fiber of my being. It is not... you have to have a really... like positive relationship to adrenaline.
Oh yeah, I
don't. To work in a restaurant kitchen. I do not. I don't like adrenaline. It's so much more repetitive than you would think. I've always had a hard time understanding what would be so cool about being a chef.
Well, I mean,
because it just seems, I mean, if you have even like set foot in a restaurant, I think even as an intern like I did, I think right away I don't know. I mean, I think unless you're really drawn to hierarchical cultures.
Yeah, which some people are, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think that might be a draw for some. But oh my God, it's just brutal. It's absolutely brutal.
Yeah. Which, I mean, like, you know, nothing but respect for people who do it.
Exactly. No, I mean...
at least the ones who aren't monsters.
Yes. No, I have nothing but respect for the people who are able to do it. And do it with real longevity.
Yeah, no, I think it's great to have the experience of like trying something out and immediately realizing, okay, this is absolutely not the job for me. Like I had that same experience, but working in a biomedical research lab. Mm. I was like, okay, I'm going to be a scientist. And I got that job like as of like the end of like day one. I'm like, I am not going to be a scientist.
I had the same experience too.
Yeah.
I was there for a whole summer.
But, yeah, I think I made it like 3 months before I quit.
Yeah. No, it becomes very clear right away. Like either you can hang with the pipetman's thumb or you cannot.
I could not.
But, you know, Tom, to answer the question of age, I do think that there's a reason why it tends to be a young person's game.
Yeah.
It is so physically demanding.
Having said that, like friend of the show, Neil Robertson became a professional pastry chef, I think in his late 40s. And had a very, you know, worked in like major kitchens, like in Las Vegas, you know, trained in France, opened his own pastry shop that was very successful, and then retired. Mm-hmm. I don't think most people could do that. I think he's kind of a special case.
Well, and I think, too, that I don't know. I don't know Neil as well as you do, but I imagine that maybe starting as late as he did meant that he already really had a sense of self.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so, therefore, maybe was able to weather some of the storms and pressures that would be harder for a younger person. So maybe in a way it did benefit him.
Yeah.
I don't know. All right. Well, Matthew, do you have a now but wow?
Yeah, I have a quick now but wow. I mentioned this show back when I was watching it, but I've been finding myself itching to rewatch Hometown Cha-Cha-Cha on Netflix, which is it's a Korean drama about a dentist from Seoul who moves to a small coastal town. And there's a romance. She falls in love, but also meets a whole bunch of lovable small town eccentrics. This show has tons of amazing Korean food. It has some of the best cute kid acting you will ever see in your life. And the story is totally formulaic and doesn't really matter because really you just want to spend more time with these characters who you've come to appreciate.
And did you watch it with subtitles or is it dubbed?
Your choice, but I think subtitles is better. Yeah. The dubbing is not great.
Yeah, great. Okay. So that's Hometown Cha-Cha-Cha on Netflix.
Our producer is Abby Circatella.
Mm-hmm. And you can rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Please do. And go ahead and let us know what we got wrong about champagne or what was the other thing we wanted people to tell us. If you're a party person.
Oh, yeah. If you're a party person, I want to know, what do you think that different types of alcohol have, like, differing degrees of severity and hangovers?
You know what we're going to get? We're going to get some people saying, yes, I think so. And other people saying, no, I don't think
so. That's right. That's
but
exactly
all,
right.
You're all party people. In our hearts, all of our listeners are party people. Like, I party inside my heart.
Okay. All right.
Oh, and that would be at everythingspilledmilk.reddit.com is where you find the party people online.
Matthew, thank you so much for making 600 episodes of this show with me.
Thank you. You know what I would like to do now
what?
For our next adventure together is record episode 601.
Okay, here we go.
I'm Matthew Hamster Burton.
I'm Molly Weisenberg. The show where we cook something delicious and you can't have any.
And we made the slogan. We edited it down to make it a little more concise for episode 600, not intentionally.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Oh, yes.
That was anticlimactic.
No, but it was nice.
Okay, great.
It was nice.
I wanted it to fly across the cork, to fly across the room, and it didn't. This is going great so far, don't you think?
This is going really well. Do you want to start over?
No, I don't.
Let's drink a toast. Are we drinking this toast to...
to spilled milk, to all of our listeners. But okay, so what, let's,
okay.
this is our best episode.
Should we, like, start over?
Wait,
do you want to start over?
We've nailed it.
You want to start over?
I want to start over, but I want Abby to use all of this thus far as the outtake.
Okay, perfect.
That's going to be our 600 episodes.
I'm going to take off my shirt because I'm too hot.
Yeah, me too.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday, and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at oceocean.com.